Good afternoon, and welcome to Soundbites, WXXI's new weekly program for everyone who uses a computer at work or at home so you'll get the most out of it. I'm Bob Smith, and you might call this release 1.0 of Soundbites. Get ready to dial 263-WXXI and speak with today's guests. First, we'll be talking with personal computing pioneer Adam Osborne about how to get your older computer to perform more like the newer models and how to get the best value in software. Then PC World Editor-in-Chief Richard Landry joins us on Live Line later in the broadcast to give us a look ahead to a new and revolutionary world of applications that is starting up even as we speak, as well as how to handle the power that's available here and now. Richard Helen Bolton of Cornell University will explain why there are no bad computers. All this coming up following this week's computer news. IBM says it's going to be shipping Personal System 2 computers with the new, more powerful 486 chip this fall, saying the machines with Intel's new central processor will be in stores before Christmas. Right now, the 386 chip powers the fastest PC-compatible systems on the market. Prototype tests on PS2s using a variety of application software show the 486 to be up to 50% faster. Meanwhile, Intel, the maker of the 486 chip and its predecessors, has announced a long-range development program for still more powerful chips, with a goal of creating a Series 786 chip with the equivalent of 100 million transistors, that's 25 to 100 times the power of current chips, sometime within the next decade. Another IBM announcement this week concerns optoelectronics, the firm saying its scientists have developed chips able to receive and transmit up to a billion bits of data per second over fiber optic lines. That's 50 times denser than earlier components for fiber optic networks. Scientists say this development will speed the establishment of a proposed national data highway. That's a $5 billion project designed to transmit computer data and high-resolution images between the nation's supercomputer centers. The technology is expected to link home receivers for video and computer data transmissions eventually. One more item about Big Blue: the computer giant is buying almost a 20% stake in one of its significant clients, Policy Management Systems Corporation of Columbia, South Carolina. IBM could eventually raise its stake in this developer of specialized turnkey systems for business and government applications as high as 30%. The financially troubled Wang Laboratories has a new chief executive. Richard Miller, the former head of GE's Consumer Electronics Group, is taking over a firm that has just announced a $424 million loss for the 1988-89 fiscal year. Miller says he sees himself as a team builder whose main task in turning Wang around will be to improve customer service while trimming costs. Miller replaces Frederick Wang, the son of company founder Dr. Ann Wang. The elder Wang remains as chairman, and Miller says he and Dr. Wang will be working closely to take costs out of the company. Tandy Corporation says its profits were flat for the fourth quarter and rose only 2.2% for the entire 1989 fiscal year. Analysts say lukewarm results and efforts to sell the personal computers line to business are to blame, but they see a turnaround now that Tandy has won part of American Airlines' big 50,000-unit personal computer contract. It seems the bigger the name, the better the results when it comes to personal computer sales. The respected market research firm Audits and Surveys Incorporated is reporting this week that IBM and Apple are showing big gains in personal computer unit sales for the first half of this year, leading a 24% gain in the overall market. But off-brands and lesser-known makes are actually showing a slight decline. As far as what kinds of computers we're buying, the survey says the biggest growth is in mid-range desktop models. What companies are making the most extensive use of PCs? Well, PC Magazine has been surveying major American firms and found out that outside the manufacturers and sellers of the systems themselves, General Electric is the firm that uses the most, with over 45,000 installed. The top 10 also includes, in order, Ford, DuPont, GM, GTE, General Dynamics, Westinghouse, Boeing, Rochester's own Eastman Kodak, and Merrill Lynch. Kodak's ratio of one PC for every three U.S. employees makes it one of the most intensive per capita users of personal computers. A third defendant has pleaded innocent to charges he and five other men conspired to violate U.S. export laws by selling computer secrets to the Soviet Union. The U.S. Attorney's Office in Seattle says Shiv Mohan of New Delhi, India, entered the plea before U.S. Magistrate Philip Swigert, who set trial for October 16th. The three were arrested July 21st in Buffalo as they met with Robert Kasperson, president of CTEC, a Kirkland computer firm. The three met at a hotel there allegedly to discuss plans to divert almost $1 million in computer equipment through Canada to the Soviet Union. Does a typical student know more about computers than his teacher? Well, teachers themselves are admitting just as much. Pollster Richard Werthlin asking 1,100 teachers across the nation whether they think computers could help in the classroom and whether they're ready to use them as teaching tools. Over 3 out of 4 say yes to that question, but a majority of teachers surveyed also admit they're computer illiterate, 52% conceding that they know less about computers than their students do. They say they want more computer training. And that's this week's Computer News. Listening to Soundbites on WXXI 1370. I'm Bob Smith. This program, of course, is about making the most of your PC, Mac, or whatever machine you happen to be using, old or new. Now, you may have thought from the news items at the top of the broadcast about more powerful hardware and, of course, the software to take advantage of it, that if you have an older machine, you may very well be left behind. But the good news is, you might be surprised at how much those older machines can do, if they are properly programmed and properly set up for the demands of today's marketplace. And, of course, we want to invite you to call in at 263-WXXI, 263-9994 right now, because in just a minute or two, you're going to be getting some guidance on precisely that subject. To tell you how to get the most out of your older machine, and we have a man on the live line with us from California who has been a major player in the personal computing field ever since its infancy. He is Adam Osborne. He first burst on the scene as a major hardware manufacturer at the beginning of the decade, but although that adventure ended in the midst of the big industry shakeout a few years ago, his involvement in the personal computing field by no means has come to an end. He is today a major publisher of economically priced software, and he is on the live line with us right now. It is good to have you with us. Welcome to the program. Let me ask you, first of all, the bulk of today's machines, let's face it, are not these new sophisticated machines with the most advanced chips that we're hearing about today. Most people out there are using basically machines that are of previous generations, aren't they?
That is correct.
And of course, that means that most people are not necessarily able to take advantage of all of the most sophisticated software that's out there today, are they?
Well, yes and no. The capabilities are there. It's just you have to look beyond the advertising, and it really is all there. You know, what's happening is that people are bamboozled into thinking that you have to have the highest speed machine and the highest, best this and the best that. It's not really true.
Now, of course, the literature that's out there nowadays, even the reviews of equipment, talk a lot about, oh, gee, we can run with this brand new chip that's out. Of course, you've heard about this 486 chip that's out, this central processing integrated circuit that is going to be the heart of the next generation of computers. And they say, wow, this is going to run programs that are out there right now anywhere from 25% faster to 50% faster to almost double speed on this. And people obviously are going to be knocked out and say, wow, we ought to have that. But not necessarily so, you said.
That is correct.
Now, let's talk a little bit about, first of all, the disadvantages of the older machines vis-a-vis the new ones, if in fact there are any that can't be overcome. By staying with an older machine rather than going to the updated technology, if I can afford it, what am I losing?
The major thing that you're not going to get is speed. You know, people get seduced into having things happen instantly. We live in the instant gratification generation. And when you really think about it, what happens is a 15-second delay for something to happen becomes forever, and people are willing to pay a lot of money so that the 15-second goes down to 1.5 seconds. And if you're going to have that 15-second delay occurring 20 times, then after a while the 15 seconds becomes a real drag and you want it to be 1.5 seconds. But if you really look at it, 15 seconds 10 times a day is not that much time.
We're talking 2.5 minutes out of a workday.
Right.
And for saving 2.5 minutes a workday, we're actually being asked to scrap whole systems and whole machines and pay tens of thousands of dollars in some cases to set up networks of new machines then.
That is correct.
Economically, then, at times, it probably doesn't make a whole lot of sense for a lot of users, does it?
It really doesn't. Large corporations in particular get suckered into this thing. Before very long, the MIS department says you've got to have the latest, you've got to have the best, or else they start bringing in new machines. And once one guy has it, becomes a status symbol. Now everybody needs to have this fastest machine. And then, of course, you've got the memory limitations. People right now, 640K, that's K is 1,048, so 640K is like 640,000 bytes of memory, is supposed to be a big barrier these days. It's not really. It's only a barrier because software companies are incompetent in the way they generate software.
So what you're saying is they're making the programs a lot more complex than they have to be.
It's not even complex. They're misdesigned. Is really what they are. The major thing is the question of when do you keep your data in memory and when do you keep your data on disk. Now, let's take the spreadsheet example. Spreadsheets are today a programming environment or programming language. Now, we learned long ago, in the 40s, that when you have data in a programming language, you keep that on disk, you don't put that in memory. Okay? Well, this all suddenly ended with the start of spreadsheets. People have spreadsheets, they keep their data in the spreadsheet in memory. And now at the latest versions, Lotus 1.2.3 Revision 3.0 coming out, it is an abomination in terms of its design. It is suggesting that you keep all your data in memory. And, I mean, they're talking about huge amounts of data, all of which you're going to have to keep in memory if you want to use the program. This is such ridiculous nonsense, because data is supposed to be kept on disk. You're supposed to bring it in when you need it, use it, and then put out what you worked on back on disk. This is the right way to do it. You do it that way, and you don't need any more than 640K RAM. You don't need these megabyte machines that they're now trying to foist on it.
So what you're saying is there's a fundamental mistake in the way the whole thing has been set up.
Absolutely.
Now, of course, that we should mention, of course, that you are putting out a competing and less expensive version of software to do a lot of the same things that that particular program that you're talking about, the Lotus 1.2.3, is doing. And shall we assume for the moment that when you bring out an analogous program, or if you have one out already, you're not going to be making the same mistakes?
That is correct. We already have one that's pretty analogous, and it would be no secret to say any time we have a product, we're coming out with a new version of it, because if we're not, then we're killing the product. We are not going to make that mistake. You know, we know a little bit more about software than Lotus does. Lotus is run by a guy who's basically a marketing management type. He doesn't know anything about software. We do, you know. We've designed it properly so that the data exists on disk, not in memory. You can do all of the same kinds of things and a great deal more. If you wanted to do the same things with the Lotus product that you can do with our product, VP Planner, you would have to have in excess of 100 million bytes of memory.
And that's a pretty heavy-duty system.
That is correct.
Now, if you look at that, and of course we're talking about a major difference in cost too, aren't we?
Yes, we're roughly half that price.
Now, that brings me to a couple of things which I want to get to. But first of all, let's talk a little bit more, if we can, about the way systems are being set up these days. What I'm hearing from you is that a lot of people are basically creating programs to match up with and essentially to use up all of the new capability that's being put into the machines. In other words, what they will do is as soon as you've got a new machine, somebody's going to come up with a program with a few extra bells and whistles on it that'll use it all up.
Oh, always. Absolutely always.
And what are you getting from it?
Not very much. You know, you really aren't. You're getting it to be a little faster sometimes, a little prettier. For example, right now, the big argument is, do you OS2 or not OS2? We've all worked with an operating system called DOS. The new version of it is OS2. What does OS2 really give you that DOS doesn't? It gives you a prettier, graphically more pleasing interface. It doesn't give you anything that you can't do with DOS.
I have a feeling that we're stirring up a little controversy here, even as we speak, and I'd be interested to hear what some of you think who are listening right now at 263-WXXI, 263-9994. A man who minces absolutely no words at all, Adam Osborne, is on the live line with us, and we'd like to hear from you as well. He seems to be suggesting that perhaps in a lot of ways we are making life a little bit more difficult for ourselves than it needs to be, and that we could get along just nicely with earlier, older, perhaps a little bit less technically sophisticated, but nevertheless workable machinery, software, and hardware than we're doing right now. And we'd like to hear from you and your thoughts and perhaps some guidance, seek some guidance as to how best to take advantage of what you have, whether it be old or new. And the number is 263-WXXI, 263-9994, here on the Soundbites program. We'll get to the phones in just a moment. But for the moment, if I may, let's dwell also on those people who do want to take advantage of whatever bells and whistles are out there. Is there a way to upgrade in terms of either software or in terms of hardware, some of those older PCs that are out there, and is there any reason to do so?
Well, the hardware, definitely. There is people that come out with new versions of the CPU board. They come out with more memory boards. You can have an ancient machine and you can bring it up to the most modern capabilities if you want to spend the money. Sure, you can do it. Absolutely. There is nothing you cannot upgrade. It's just going to cost.
Even one of those oldies but goodies like an original PC.
Oh, yeah.
Well, that's reassuring to me because that's precisely what I have at home. And 263-WXXI for your questions at home or office or whatever. Let's go to them right now. Good morning, or good afternoon, I should say. You're on the air.
Good morning. Afternoon. I have a question. I have a Macintosh 128. Okay. And I'm heading towards desktop publishing needs with it and can't find any software that 128K, which is not a particularly small computer, will run. My option, since Apple offers no buyback program, is to sell the computer through the paper and upgrade, I guess, to a 1 megabyte machine or put in a new board. Any advice?
I'd go ahead and upgrade. The 128K Macintosh was the Steve Jobs disaster. He had a thing about not having fans in computers, and if you were going to put everything in the Macintosh that they should have had in the first place, a fan would have gone along with it to dissipate the heat. That early 128K Macintosh is essentially worthless. You've got to have that 1 megabyte of RAM. The machine is actually very powerful, very useful once you get that amount of memory in it. And those larger Macintoshes are now beginning to make major, major inroads into the corporate marketplace.
So should I replace the boards in this machine, or for approximately $1,300, should I buy a 1 megabyte Macintosh?
I'd buy the 1 megabyte and just move on it. The machine you have is totally obsolete.
Okay, thank you very much.
And thank you very much for calling. Let's take another call right now at 263-WXXI. I do have a couple of lines open, and we invite you to join in the conversation. Hi, you're on the air.
Yes.
Go ahead, please.
Oh.
Don't be bashful. Uh-huh. Go ahead.
Sorry, I'm hearing the delay here.
Oh, that's another thing we want to remind you. Yeah. Please turn down your radio. We are on 10-second delay. Make sure that won't confuse you.
Okay, my question is, I have a 1 megabyte Atari, and they just moved up with the 2 megabyte and 4 megabyte. The benefit there is you can run more than one program at a time. And if I were to put in another board, would I be able to run the two programs, or if I use the hard drive, would I be able to do that? Just know anything about that.
Well, first of all, the Atari is a kind of a world of its own, and I frankly know very, very little about the Atari ST. The idea of running two programs at a time, let's just stop on that one a minute. If you are going to do that, it means that you have one program, say, executing in the background and the other one going in the foreground that you're actually, what's the keyboard connected to? What's the screen connected to? Do you want to go back to that one and come forward to this one, etc.?
Right. Well, what I'm doing is I'm recording music, so I have one program that does all the music, the sequencing, the composing, and if I want to edit a voice or a horn part or whatever, I'd like to be able to do that without having
That's an area where Atari dominates completely. That's one of the few areas Atari really is ahead there in that music.
That's
a heck of a good market for it. And there, what you want to do is probably very valuable. Yes, you are going to effectively have one program in the background, one in the foreground, and it's worth doing. Now, I know so little about the Atari product line that I would hesitate to give you specific advice, other than to say if you get whatever Atari tells you you need in order to have the two programs running simultaneously, by all means do it, but take their advice. Don't take mine, because I know so little about the Atari ST.
Okay, and the general question is, would adding a hard drive, would that add to my speed, or would that just add to my memory?
Normally it would add to your off-RAM memory. In other words, the bulk storage. It's not going to help you a great deal for your speed. Unless you get a faster disk or something like that.
Okay. All right, well, thank you.
Okay, and good luck with your composition efforts. Thanks for calling. 263-WXXI, our number, and good afternoon. You're on the air.
Yes, I have a question. I know you guys talked about the Atari one. The question is, I have a 130XC Atari computer, it's 8-bit, and I was wondering, they have these memory upgrades, other bags, sort of whatever, and I was wondering, is it worth the effort to, you know, expand the 30XC, the 8-bit, last bit of the last one of their 8-bit computers, or would you recommend possibly upgrading to a better computer?
You know, the Atari line is one I know just about nothing about. I don't have one, I've never used one. I'm limited to general knowledge about computers in general, and I'd hesitate really to start making any specific recommendations for fear that I'll be talking about out of my head, you know.
Mm. Okay, well, I'm just kind of wondering because I've had this for a couple of years here now, and it's getting to the point where you see all these computers around and think that you can do almost anything that's possibly available there.
Well, go look at what they have, and don't think that you bought too early. I mean, look at, have you gotten 2 years of value for the money you paid?
I would say yes.
In that case, you know, move on. Go and get the next thing up that does what you want to do, providing you look at these capabilities and say, heck yes, I can use that, rather than, well, this is out, it's better. Since it's better, I'm not sure how I'm going to use this better feature, but I'll go ahead and get it because it's there. That's stupid. But on the other hand, you can see the real advantages that come from buying this new capability. Then that's the basis for going ahead and getting it.
Because my son, he's started school for you, and I know kids are confused and stuff. I want to get something that possibly gets to school that they can use. And I'll be able to use also to be around for a little while.
Well, you know, if you're going to get something for a kid at school, I would not get an Atari.
Okay.
And the reason is because you want the kid to learn something that the kid can use later on.
Right.
And the industry is entirely IBM PC and now Macintosh. And you're going to have to get one or the other of those so that the kid learns things that will subsequently be valuable at school.
Right. Okay. He's just studying elementary school, but I know they got confused. And I just want to get something that he could use.
Right. Well, even at elementary schools now, they're getting Macintoshes and IBM PCs.
Okay.
Best of luck to you, and thank you very much for calling.
Goodbye.
263-WXXI, good afternoon. You're on the air with us.
Hi, yes. Mr. Osborne. I just want to tell you that a number of years ago, I owned and sold Osborne 1. I thought they were wonderful. And I wanted to thank you not only for a great machine, but for the down payment on my house.
Good.
For those of you in the audience who don't know, Mr. Osborne used to sell a computer called the Osborne 1, which in its day was the hottest product out.
Well, thank you.
Yeah, not only the hardware, but the bundle of the software made it an awfully easy machine to sell and an awfully nice machine to use. Thank you very much.
Well, thank you.
And thank you very much for calling. That raises another question which I'd like to ask. I remember portable machines were part of your major stock in trade early on. And I'm wondering what you think of the laptops and the portables that are out there right now, because IBM's making a big promotional splash, getting a lot of ink about this 21-pound new PS2 machine that they're selling right now, 386 base. They're selling it for about $7,000 or $8,000, about the price of a halfway decent new car. What do you think of it?
Well, IBM has never done very well in that laptop market, and I wouldn't touch it. But what? It's, first of all, 21 pounds today is way too heavy. The way to go is with the what we call the flat screen display units. They're much cheaper, much easier to carry around. You try and open up one of those laptops in an airplane and use it, and you won't get very far because you don't have enough battery to use it without having a power outlet to go into. And, you know, quite frankly, I found that where I use a laptop the most is when I'm flying.
But, of course, they're being enthused over in some of the trade publications, but you're saying don't be so quick to grab it and embrace it, then.
That's right. And look and see, what are you going to do with it, first of all? Now, I have a laptop. I make extensive use of the laptop because I fly a lot. I get in the airplane, I pull out my laptop, and I start to do some useful work. I've got to have a battery. If you have a battery, you've got to have a flat-screen display. You can't have a cathode ray tube type display and run it with a battery. It uses too much power.
So essentially what you're saying is that IBM has blown it again.
IBM has not done well in the laptop market. And I think if IBM had really looked at the problem properly, they could do very well. IBM have not done well in that market. They've not done well in the software market. In both cases, it's because people running those two segments of IBM's business don't know their business. It's that simple.
In other words, they're operating without a clue, in your opinion. Is what
That's right.
Do. Now, if they're not doing it right, who is?
Laptops. Mostly these days, the Japanese laptops are great. Toshiba has a fabulous one. Zenith in America has a fabulous one. There are a number of laptops around. Take your pick, you know, but make sure that it is quite light. Make sure that it has the capabilities you're looking for. There are some brand new laptops that are now coming out, which are what we call notebook computers that are ultralight. And now watch out, because a lot of those ultralights are close to worthless because they don't have any disk storage. You can only keep what you can put into memory.
So it's definitely buyer beware, then.
It's buyer beware. Make sure that you know what you're getting and that you can use it.
And I wish we had more time to speak, but this segment is through, and I have only time to say thank you to Adam Osborne for joining us on Live Line. You're listening to Sound Bites. Listening to Sound Bites on WXXI 1370, I'm Bob Smith. And of course, 263-WXXI is the number that you called to join us on the Live Line. Our top story this week has been about new hardware, specifically that new central processing unit chip or integrated circuit. It's the Intel 486 that is about to ship in IBM's Personal System 2 and other machines, possibly late this fall. Now, that sounds like an interesting technical development, but what you're probably asking if you're a non-technical person, and I must admit I'm among those, is what's that going to mean to us as users? And where are we going from here in terms of greater power and greater capability to do the kinds of things that we want to do with our computers? Our PC World Editor-in-Chief Richard Landry says this could mean a lot to us in a practical way. Now, he's on Live Line with us from the San Francisco Bay Area right now to explain not only why this new microprocessor could be even more important than its makers believe, but to tell you what you can expect to do with your personal computers in the future as this technology continues to develop. We've got an exciting and brave new world in many fields, and Richard Landry is on live line to give us a peek ahead and to answer your questions about where the technology is going and what you can make use of today in the technology that's already here. Richard, good to have you with us.
Hi, how are you doing today?
Doing very fine, thank you. Now, this new circuit, this integrated circuit chip, it's called Intel, which is manufacturing it and bringing it out, calls it evolutionary. But you say in your latest column in PC World that it's potentially revolutionary. Why?
That's right. Well, the thing is that although the Intel processor has been designed, the 486 has been designed to be compatible with the previous processors that people would have owned if they had bought an IBM PC or a compatible, like the 8088 processor and the 286 and even the 8386. It's compatible with all of those, but it's so much faster that it really does sort of represent a revolution. And what I mean by that is if you look back and see the difference between the kinds of computers that were out there with the IBM PC XT, and then when the AT came out, there was an enormous jump in the kinds of things that people could do with their PCs. Whereas the old PC was very, very slow and could only be suitable for really personal office tasks, as soon as the 286 came out, people started networking these computers together. That made a big change. Now this 486 computer will be at least 100% faster than the fastest PC around right now. And what that means is that opens up the door to enormous new possibilities in software design.
Now, of course, we've got a little debate going, I think, here on the program. As you know, Adam Osborne was on here a few minutes ago, and he said, and I think quite starkly, that maybe some of the benefits of speed have been somewhat overrated. Is, in his words, what difference does it make whether it takes you 15 seconds to bring up a program and get it running, or 5 seconds, or what have you? After all, it's only a few minutes a day. He seemed to say that all this speed business that's been talked about in magazines, including yours, was overrated. I'm hearing something very different from you on this side of the debate, aren't I?
Well, actually, you can have it both ways. Adam is absolutely right. If what you're talking about is buying the fastest PC alive today in order to be able to run, let's say, WordPerfect or WordStar or Lotus 1-2-3, in other words, run today's software, then there really is no difference, and you might as well just buy the cheapest PC you can get. But these PCs that are being developed now, the 33 megahertz 386 computers and then the new 486 computers, are really designed for a new class of software that's not around today and won't be around for a year or so. And that new software won't be able to run on the older, slower PCs. So it's sort of like a shift in the quality of software that really is we're waiting for in order to unleash the potential of these new machines. But Adam's exactly right that for today's needs, for today, I mean 1989, these older computers will do just fine. But by mid-1990 and 1991, which is not very far away, there will be new kinds of software available that will require these new machines. And these will be qualitatively different kinds of software than we have right now.
Okay, now I'm getting both a little bit excited and a little bit scared about what you're talking about. First of all, I'll tell you why I'm a touch scared. It sounds like a lot of the new software that's coming out, a lot of the new applications that are going to be available, would that mean that I might very well have to junk my old IBM PC or some similar machine?
Well, I think it sort of depends on what you want to do with your computer. The computers that are out right now, the PCs that use 1-2-3 and WordPerfect, I think people, generally speaking, agree that these computers are very hard to use. If you put a PC in front of somebody who has never used a computer before and say, okay, in an hour and a half, I want you to knock out a letter for me, or I want you to do a mail merge, or I want you to calculate these figures for our upcoming budget, chances are very likely that by the time you come back, the work won't be done and the person will have been reduced to tears. They're just simply too hard to use. Now, the PC doesn't cost that much for a business, maybe $3,000, and the software doesn't cost that much, maybe another $1,000 on top of it. But you're not getting that much benefit out of having that person sitting in front of that PC and getting very frustrated and doing work slowly. this new class of PC and software that goes with it promises to make the whole job of using computers much, much easier so that the people who use the PCs get a lot more benefit out of it, significantly more benefit. I mean, like, maybe 10 times more benefit, more productivity than they're getting right now. There have been a few studies done that have shown that when you go out and buy today's kind of PC and install it in a business, generally speaking, for all your time and effort and heartache, you get about a 10% increase in productivity from the people who are using the PCs. That's not very much, really.
That's 10% as opposed to doing it by hand.
Right, 10% as opposed to doing it by hand. Now, that's actually a kind of dismal figure when you stop and think about all the work involved in setting up PCs and establishing standards in a company. It's enough to pay for the PCs, but just about enough. This new class of software is designed really with the goal in mind of increasing productivity to a much, much greater level than that by making computers much simpler, easier to use, in a way that makes you feel like the computer is working for you and you're not working for it.
So we're talking about the potential for software for relative computer dummies, then.
We're talking about eliminating the concept of being computer illiterate. In other words, right now, in order for you to use a computer well, you have to become computer literate. You have to understand how computers work. Well, why shouldn't it be the other way around? I mean, after all, computers are designed for the service of human beings. Why can't computers learn how you work and adapt themselves accordingly to your style? And that's really what this new generation of PC hardware and software is all about.
And this sounds like an exciting and brave new world. And if you're curious about it, we invite you to dial in at 263-WXXI, 263-9994. That's our number. The program is Sound Bites. And this afternoon on the live line with me from California, Richard Landry, who is the editor-in-chief of PC World magazine. We're talking about the new developments. We're talking about what they're going to mean to you and what you can look forward to just months from now as some of this new hardware ships. And who knows, maybe we'll be seeing some new software coming along to take advantage of it as well. 263-WXXI, that's 263-9994. You tested some popular application programs that are already out there. And you say the first thing that you noticed on a prototype of this machine with this new chip was they all seem to run a lot faster.
That's right. But I think, you know, Adam Osborne's remark that the difference between 15 seconds and 5 seconds to do a task, or the difference between a minute and a half and a half a minute, in the big scheme of things, is not really that great. And in fact, the more we think about speed and power as the hallmarks of our next generation, the more depressed you can get about the price tag that it's going to be. When, you know, looking at how fast machines run and how fast they perform software, it's sort of like looking at computers with old eyes. It's like thinking of computers as they were originally thought of by the computer technical people of the 1970s, where what they thought of computers as data processing machines. They were stuck in very cold rooms in universities or in big companies, and the whole idea behind them was to crunch numbers or to process giant databases faster, a little bit faster than perhaps the machines before them. Well, personal computers are a very different class of machine, and to think about them in the same way as you think of the old giant mainframe is probably not a the best idea. PCs are designed to be personal machines, and that is your machine and my machine. And we're one of the benefits of them is we can work with that machine so that it adapts itself to our work style, so that when we walk in the morning and turn on our machine, it is geared towards the kind of work we have to do that day. And if there's new power that's coming down the line, and there is, and if it's geared towards making my work life more efficient, then the kinds of benefits we're going to get out of it have really nothing to do with whether it goes faster or slower. It has to do with whether I as an employee or I as a worker have greater power in my job.
Sounds exciting, and it looks as though we're going to be able to do it better. And I want to get to the phone lines right now at 263-WXXI to answer your questions as to how this brave new world might be coming about and what it's going to do for you. Good afternoon. You're on the air.
Yeah, I just wanted to comment. Both the current speaker, the guy from PC Magazine, and Adam Osborne have agreed on everything. I mean, Osborne was talking about the speed of the machine not being the issue with software design, and I hear the PC Magazine guy saying the same thing, but not in the same words. I know personally I was in a job where I used a standard PC for a while, and now I'm using a Macintosh, and I think the PC machine was technically faster, but the Macintosh, it doesn't matter that it performs a task twice as fast if I don't have to spend 10 minutes in the manual. That's real time savings. You know, so it is an ease of use issue. It's not really, I don't think the new chips are that big a deal, is what I'm saying.
Well, what you're saying is the way it's all set up and formatted, you're saying the Macintosh machine is just an easier machine to use?
Right, and it's more productive because you know how to use it. You have to learn it once. And it doesn't matter how fast the machine is, if you have to relearn every time you've been away from a program for 2 weeks or something, you have to go and open the manual again. And it's not completely gone with the Macintosh, but it's less of an issue.
I bet you we've got the nucleus of a real debate going here right now. Of course, let's face it, that's the debate of the marketplace, isn't it?
Well, the fact of the matter is that Macintoshes are a heck of a lot easier to use than IBM PCs. And if you look at what's been happening over the last year and a half, really, what you can see is that IBM and Microsoft, really, the two companies that are responsible for the basic operating system software for IBM PC machines, they've both been moving in a direction to make IBM PCs a lot more Macintosh-like. Now, that's a sort of a hard test because we're overlaying ease-of-use software on top of a machine that really wasn't designed to be an easy-to-use machine. When IBM introduced the PC, they expected they would sell maybe about 30 or 40,000 of those machines tops, and they would all go to programmers. Now we've got about 40 million IBM machines worldwide, IBM standard machines worldwide, used by a lot of people who don't know anything about programming. And so IBM and Microsoft have sort of had to go back and retrofit the IBM standard with new software that is easier to use. Now, one of the points that the caller made was that when you sit down with a Macintosh, you really only have to learn how to use the machine once. That's because all the software that's in a Macintosh is formatted the same way so that to cut or copy some information or to save it or to pass it to another program, every program operates the same. Well, that consistency is a very important thing, and it leads to a lot of ease of use. But this next generation of software is even going to go beyond that, where more intelligence is going to be added into the software so that even if you don't know exactly what you're driving at, the computer understands what the possibilities are, what are all the possible things you might want to do, and it helps you figure out what exactly you want to do. Now, that's the kind of software that we don't have even on the Macintosh right now. I have an editor at work who pasted on a phony key on his keyboard, and the name of the key is DWIM, the DWIM key, which means do what I mean. And he just fantasizes that he could just press that do what I mean key, and the computer would do what he means. Well, his fantasy is about to become reality.
Well, that's intriguing. I want to find out a little bit more about that. And I'm sure all of our other callers at 263-WXXI, which we invite you to join in, I will want to know about that too, because that sounds, I mean, my first thought is, well, that's getting close to artificial intelligence.
Mm-hmm. Well, it's funny. You know, artificial intelligence or expert systems were for a long, long time thought of as a category of software. In other words, you would go out and buy an expert system package. In fact, you can do that from Adam Osborne. He has a very nice package entitled VP Expert. But as that whole category of software has matured, what we've seen is that the people who produce word processors, spreadsheets, database, communications program want to adopt some expert system concepts in their software. And so although expert systems will be an important product category and people will build software that on top of expert systems, more importantly, expert system concepts will be in every bit of software that you'll buy.
So it will be able to figure out, to a certain degree, take cues from what you're trying to do and figure out what you're trying to do and do it for you, even if you haven't quite entered it just right.
Right, exactly. And we're sort of seeing the first inklings of that in programs like Microsoft Quick Basic, where if you're trying to do some programming in Quick Basic and you're not sure what to do next, you can hit the help key and it'll pop up usually an appropriate help screen with an example that you can cut and paste right into your program. Now, that's help for programmers, and they're probably the people who need it the least because they're very technically savvy. But with that program, Quick Basic, Microsoft was trying to make a statement, actually, that they're going to start including this kind of help in every kind of software that they produce, including their Excel spreadsheet and Microsoft Word, Word Processor, and other packages they haven't released yet.
That's good news for people like me who have a tendency to wear out the help key.
Exactly.
263-WXXI, good afternoon. You're on the air.
Yeah, I wanted to talk about, you're talking a lot about a lot of sophisticated equipment. I wanted to talk about some of the cheap stuff. The reason is because I'm a teacher, and even though Mr. Osborne mentioned that IBMs and Macintosh are being seen in the elementary school, I can tell you in this area at least that the only place you'll see a Macintosh in an elementary school is in the principal's office.
Hmm.
And the only place that I ever see an IBM would be in high school. Some high schools have them, but it is still largely Apple IIs. In fact, that there's going to be continued development in some of the cheaper computers. Also, another thing is something like a Commodore 64,
mm-hmm.
which is not a very powerful machine yet. There's 10 million of them. And are the people going to continue to develop these programs?
It's a good question. I think there are really two things that work there. One is that the cost of hardware has continued to drop over the last several years, and that means that for, let's say, the $500 that it costs to buy an Apple II E or Apple II C today, in a couple of years, that $500 is going to buy a lot more machine. And the truth of the matter is that you need more machine in order to make computers easier to use. That's sort of a problem that we're... the people who need the easy-to-use machines, like in education or in small business, are often the same people who can't afford very expensive, sophisticated equipment.
Right, and also, sorry to interrupt, but as far as the way schools do budgets, and if you have any idea the way public schools do budgets, in the early, mid-80s, schools across America invested hundreds of millions of dollars in Apple.
Right.
The idea that they're going to say, well, we have to keep up to date with the hardware and the software, it'll probably be about another 10 years before schools are willing to make another big investment at that scale as they did before.
Exactly. Well, so that does pose a problem, and I think it's one that is going to sort of slow down the introduction of easy-to-use products in education and small business. But the flip side of that is there are a whole bunch of software developers, entrepreneurs, who see this as an opportunity. The big guys, Microsoft and Lotus and Ash and Tate, are not stepping in to provide software for those low-end machines, but many, many small developers are. And as that continues, we'll see better software arrive, although those software developers also are going to be constrained by the inherent lack of power of those machines. For example, the 2GS is really the first Apple II machine that can support a hard disk really well. And a hard disk is essential to providing graphic information to students or to small business users. And if you can't provide graphic information, then it's harder to make a program easy to use.
Okay, thank you.
Well, thank you very much for calling. 263-WXXI, 263-9994 is our number. We were talking, when we spoke earlier this weekend, before this broadcast, we were talking about some new developments that are going on even beyond this, even as these new chips that will accommodate all this new, easier-to-use software are coming out this fall, presuming that they make it out on time,
mm-hmm.
which I guess they will. Now, Intel, which is making a lot of these chips and developing them, is talking about a whole series of new generations that will keep on quadrupling and quintupling the power. First in the early 90s, there's going to be a 586 chip and then a 686 around 1995. And by the year 2000, they have already promised that they're going to have a chip which is going to be equivalent to 100 million transistors on it, that's about 100 times as powerful as the one they're just introducing
this
fall. I'm trying to envision what a machine with that kind of integrated circuit governing the whole apparatus, all the works, is going to be like and what it's going to be able to do.
Mm-hmm. Interesting point. The fact of the matter is that by the year 2000, the average PC will be more powerful than the average supercomputer today. But the other important fact is that that very, very powerful machine will still be a personal computer. In other words, it'll still be the kind of machine that you or I would want to have on our desktop. Now, what are we going to do with all that desktop power? Well, if we follow Adam Osborne's reasoning, we're not going to want to recalculate our spreadsheet more quickly. We're going to want to do things that are qualitatively different. And one of the things you can do with that kind of power is you can move a lot of graphic images around. In fact, you can move graphic images that look like they've come off of a TV or even off of a photograph. And this is opening up a whole new world of software called multimedia software. When you and I communicate right now, let's say, on this telephone, we're only communicating in one medium, and that's the medium of voice. Or not, you can't see me, I can't see you, I can't send you textual information, a memo or a report, and you can't do that either. The same thing is true, really, with PCs today. If you and I are in an office, the very best we can do is connect to each other by means of a local area network and send textual information back and forth to each other. Well, this new generation of software that Apple and IBM both are envisioning, and in fact they're in a very serious race to be the first to deliver it to PC users, this multimedia software will allow us to communicate not simply through text, but through voice and through graphics as well.
And that's
so that
going
if
to be
we're
nice.
On a network and you want to send me a message, you can not only send me a memo, but you could also send me a voice message, and you could appear on my screen in a little box with your face.
Sounds exciting, and I wish we had more time. I wish we had more time to talk about it. This segment, unfortunately, time is up for it. My thanks to Richard Landry of PC World. Alan Bolton spends most of his time as a computer services expert at Cornell University, but he's going to offer some thoughts today on the care and feeding of PCs from time to time on Soundbites. And today, well, you might call this the Woodhouse way of training your PC, or no bad computers.
Down, boy. Sit. Sit. Stay. Good boy. You know, there really are no bad computers. Old people will persist in telling horror stories, like the friend of mine who keeps telling anyone who will listen how he nearly lost a finger to a tape drive on a big and he claims vicious 3270, but I'm sure it was his own fault. I mean, would you like someone to try to stop you when you were feeding? No, I'm sure there are no bad computers, and I base my assurance on years of training them. And, you know, in all my time, I have never had a failure. On the contrary, I have found, in fact, that with the right treatment, they will positively fawn on you, and you'll end up having from time to time to kick the little buggers away. You see, the trouble that most people who have trouble have arises because those people forget that, in their natural state in the wild, computers are gregarious creatures. They live in packs, or, as the naturalist or as we professionals call them, networks. All that you really need to know about the network is that it is a simple society of dominant or submissive individuals, and that this results in the fact that that's how computers see everyone, and woe betide the computer owner who gets cast into a submissive role, because once you're there for good, and your computer will dominate you and bite your disks, and you will spend hours trying in vain to get it to do the simplest of tasks. So, to demonstrate just how easy it is, for the next few minutes, I'm going to show you how to take a young, frisky Macintosh 2CX called Rover. Yes, that's you now. Hey boy, don't get excited. How to take Rover here through his paces in his first training session. Stay, Rover. We will do it with a mixture of kindness, firmness, and a little bit of, well, frankly, a little bit of utter brutality. First, the kindness. I find that a quick tickle under the keyboard, yes, that's right, boy, a tickle under the keyboard, is the best reward. Now, some people worry about getting fleas or slobber or drool or a virus when they get that close to their computer. Don't. They are all
perfectly natural and normal accompaniments of the computer, and none of them can live on people. In fact, the only thing you have to worry about is worry itself, because your computer can sense worry and interprets it as submission. And, as I said, woe betide the computer owner who gets cast into a submissive role. Then there's firmness. This is done for computers with voice recognition software by the tone of voice, and for the others, by the vigor and speed with which you type. So I would always advise you to take a good power typing course, or the use of a finger nautilus. For brutality, I find a large rubber mallet in the CPU works wonders. Now, using these techniques, I'll get Rover to do some tricks for you. Rover, Rover. Roll over and shut down for your country. Good boy, Rover. Come here, come here. Now, you see how I tickle him to reward him. Rover, now, Rover, Rover. Rover, stop. Sit. Sit. Down. Stop doing that. Leave my leg alone. Stop it. Oh, dear. Leave my leg alone. You haven't even been introduced. Someone get a bucket of water. I'm going to have to sign off now. Remember, folks, get my leg. There are no bad computers. Where's that water? The sound bites. I'm Richard Howland Bolton. Unless you're Richard Howland Bolton.
Computer services expert Richard Howland Bolton of Cornell University, who's going to be a frequent contributor to the Sound Bites program. Next time, I wonder, will he tell us how to take his computer for walkies? Well, we shall find out, perhaps in a few weeks from now, in Richard's next appearance here on WXXI. Next week on Soundbites, you'll be meeting David Bunnell, the founder of IO Publishing and co-creator of PC World, Macworld, and PC Magazine. You're going to learn about his new project to bring inner-city youth and computers closer together. He calls it Computers and You. It's an exciting new dimension in computer education. We'll hear all about it. There's more in store, of course, as well on the Soundbites program when we return next week. Remind you of some of the people involved in the program. Adam Wilcox serves as our producer. Esther Vale and Steve Stonewell are our technical directors. I'm Bob Smith. It's been a pleasure to be with you this week on Soundbites. Hope you'll join us again next week for what we might call Release 1.1 of Soundbites here on WXXI 1370, Rochester's News Extra.